Hello, and welcome to Talking General Practice, the podcast from GP Online. I'm Emma Bauer, the editor of GP Online. On today's episode, I'm really pleased to say I'm talking to the chair of the BMA GP Committee in England, Dr. Katie Bramall-Stainer. GPs in England are facing the third consecutive contract imposition and a deal for 2024-25 that will deliver just a 1.9% uplift to funding, when practices are already facing huge financial pressure. The BMA has launched a referendum on the deal, and we're entering a crucial period for the profession that could see GPs head towards industrial action later this year. Coming up, Dr. Bramall-Stainer explains what she thinks the contract deal will mean for practices in England this year, what she hopes the referendum will achieve, and how we could get to the point of GPs taking action. She also talks about how the BMA's safe working guidance could help practices in the coming months, and explains how working in partnership with patients could help convince ministers of the need for further investment in general practice ahead of the general election. I'm really pleased to be joined on the podcast now by the chair of the BMA England GP Committee, Dr. Katie Bramall-Stainer. Katie, I know you're exceptionally busy at the minute, so thank you so much for finding the time to come on the podcast today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's really important to get the messages out there at this critical time for us all.
We're obviously here today to talk about the GP contract for 2024-25 and what happens now. You said after the final contract deal was published a week or so ago that it was part of an intentional, predetermined, strategic, ideological dismantling of NHS general practice. Can you explain why you think that and what the deal means for GPs, practices and patients?
Well, this year, as I said in your podcast in August, was going to be really important because it was the end of the PCNDES, the five-year multi-framework that we've had since 2019. And since the 1st of April 2019, the value of our contract has eroded to the tune of £620 million based on CPI. So that inflationary erosion has made a massive difference because we've had across those years a fixed uplift of 2.1% embedded. But in that time, we've had the COVID pandemic, we've seen inflation hit double figures, practices like anywhere else have not been immune to the extraordinary increases in utility bills, wage inflation increases, and we're seeing more and more practices face greater and greater obstacles. So our finance survey was really helpful in getting that contemporaneous data, because government and NHS England and the Department of Health, they all rely on the earnings and expenses data that naturally is 2 years out of date. So from their perspective, they are absolutely intransigent in considering that we are in the middle of the COVID pandemic, receiving increased income from our activity to deliver the COVID vaccination programme. And we know from evidence from practices that that income is wiped out because it's been put to one side to keep everyone's wages stable when the value of the contract has been going down and down and down. And the reason I use non-evidence-based and ideological is because we were able to provide incredibly robust quantitative data and really sensible, pragmatic, logical suggestions and solutions that would be cost neutral for the Treasury. And one example of that might be looking at bringing in additional GPs and additional practice nurses. But actually, we were suggested, no, have consultants and have staff grade doctors and have specialist nurses to presumably undertake secondary care work. And on the other end of the spectrum, we've got the additional roles reimbursement scheme that has brought these 24,000 roles delivering the 50 million additional appointments, but we've not seen sufficient evidence as to how this is improving patient outcomes. In fact, we've got evidence as to how it's widening health deprivation indices and concern from patients that they're having to see multiple people before they actually get to a diagnosis. And from our perspective, we're hearing about GPs facing unemployment and underemployment, newly qualified GPs having to take additional work. Examples given to me by some practice managers in Manchester at the weekend of Uber drivers. Now, this is extraordinary. And why would you not want to use existing ring-fence budgets from the Treasury to employ qualified GPs that the taxpayer has invested billions of pounds in their training. That's why this isn't logical. It has to be ideological, and it's not evidence-based, and there is strategy behind it, and it increasingly is feeling that it's intentional and predetermined. There's one thing about having a paucity of data, but when you've got overwhelming data from every angle, when you've got management journals coming out with how important it is to value the current model of general practice, then I think it's about time we call it out, not just for our profession, but also for patients as well.
Yeah, I'm going to come on to ask you about some of those things that you talked about in negotiations in a sec, but first of all, what sort of rise do we need to core GP funding to make practices financially viable? Obviously, the deal is 1.9%, and that's nowhere near enough. So what sort of level of funding increase were you hoping to get this year to sort of start putting general practice back on the right track?
So you're absolutely right. A 1.9% increase in real terms set against the consumer price inflation indices that the Bank of England uses and NHS England uses results in an 8.7% funding gap. So the CPI from between the 1st of April 2019 to today is 21.2%. And all the little bits and bobs that have been added to our contract over the past few years amounts to about 12.5%. And that means there's an 8.7% funding gap. And we appreciate that our economic climate is really vulnerable and volatile right now. We know we're in recession. We're watching with interest at the inflation rates, as everybody is, not least the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And so we wanted to come into this stepping stone year to try and bring things that might not mean a great deal to Treasury or to the Department of Health or NHS England, but which would make a world of difference to GPs in their practices and which would be cost neutral. But from a cost perspective, what we suggested was not actually looking at a full pay restoration. We know what our consultant colleagues are going to be offered. We've seen what staff grade colleagues have been offered. We're aware of what's been tabled for juniors. Now, if we were to go to look and use the same indices for general practice, and let's go back to 2008, which is the year that I gained my CCT as a GP, then actually the funding's reduced by 52%. And we think that juniors are asking for 35%. That puts it in context. So actually we came to the table acknowledging all of these complexities and saying, whoa, 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 okay, we want strength, we want safety, and we want stability. So in terms of getting that stability, we want a quick answer and clarity for GPs so they know exactly what they're going to be working with. And we felt that filling that funding gap of 8.7% to bring us back at least to where we were in 2019 would probably be sufficient for the next 12 months to keep the show on the road, so long as we were given these other ideas that would be cost neutral, which would make a massive difference to our feeling safe to practice and giving us hope for the future. It was about safety, stability, and hope. And I think the thing to remember is that general practice, we save the wider NHS money in the long run too. We keep our patients healthy in the community. We keep them out of hospital. That saves time, it saves resource, and it saves further funding along the patient pathway. It just doesn't make sense to strip general practice of its funding. Doing that makes an entire health system slower and less safe. The NHS Confederation was really helpful when in their paper in September, they published evidence that a pound invested in a primary care network will save £14 in GDP. And I think it's clear that there's enormous wastage to be had with practices becoming non-viable, having to hand back their contracts, necessary re-procurement costs, with worse patient outcomes. So this isn't working for the profession, and it isn't working for patients, and it doesn't work for Treasury. So it doesn't make sense. Therefore, there's a perverse ideology behind it, and that's what we have to call out.
You've talked there a little bit about some of the cost-neutral things that you put forward and you asked for, and I'm assuming all of those were rejected. Can you say a bit about any of those at all?
Happily. So as I said to you in the podcast in August, we spoke at the time about looking at examples of practices being able to potentially limit their liability and building on the work of the partnership review in 2018 to allow us to hold limited liability contracts. That might be one example, to repurpose existing funding in the PCN DES that's now going to go into the Capacity and Access Investment Framework to potentially ring fence money for supervision, training and development of teams that GP practices are responsible for supervising. Potentially also for uplifting the value of a care home bed. At the moment it's £10 per month. Can you imagine a community trust agreeing to deliver the Enhanced Health in Care Homes framework for £10 per bed per month? I don't think so. Lots of other examples as well of repurposing money that's already existing into areas that we need. And again, I would say additional GPs, additional practice nurses. And we gave worked up case examples of, I think, 4 or 5 examples in general practice of where that might be a lead GP to look at managing the care home package and team, potentially a lead GP to be providing support at a neighbourhood basis for safeguarding for children and early years and child and adolescent mental health that would then interlink beautifully to the practice leads and the system leads, to have more of a fluid approach to additional GPs to better support enhanced access, clinics and capacity to enable greater continuity of care for those patients that require it. So lots and lots of examples. And the areas where we did want more funding would be, for example, around uplifting the value of the vaccinations and immunisations tariff. That's £10.06. It's been fixed at that since back in 2020. During that time, CPI has been over 20%. So we'd like to see that rise to £12.50-something to reflect that. And the same is true for parental leave reimbursement and sickness leave reimbursement of locums. Again, that's been frozen in value since 2018. And we want to see that funding gap filled in.
The money side of things is really terrible, but is there anything in the deal that we've got now from April that is good or is a benefit that you can see from your point of view, or nothing at all?
Well, I think, I think there've been some positive changes in the quality and outcomes framework.
Right.
NHS England are suspending and income protecting 32 indicators out of the 76 of INQOF in total. But as I wrote in my letter to Andrea Leadsom today, practices are still going to have to do the work for those 32 indicators. I'm not going to not keep a mental health register. What I need for those other indicators is done by these 32. And yeah, it's great. It's a really positive move. It's very helpful indeed. Likewise, aligning indicators like the cholesterol indicator with the new NICE guidelines around definition of cholesterol control and LDL. That's really helpful. We also suggested the aspiration payments for QOF were increased as a move towards higher trust, lower bureaucracy, which, let's face it, is in the modern general practice access paper. Now, at the moment, it's 70%. But everyone listening to this podcast knows that we've had QOF for 20 years. And NHS England has got 20 years of data as to what the post-payment verification processes look like and where it's had to claw back money and where it's had to give more money. And we were told by NHS England there had been no clawback in 5 years. So therefore, we suggested you uplift the aspiration payment to more like 90%. You could probably safely do it to 95%. And they did it to 80%. And whilst we think they could have gone further, that is a step in the right direction. It's very helpful, especially for more than half of practices that told us they've faced cash flow issues in the past 12 months.
The other thing that I wanted to ask you about as well is that GP funding, for the first time for 5 years, GP funding is going to be considered as part of the independent pay review body process this year. There could be recommendations that would maybe suggest a higher uplift for general practice. Do you think it's likely that we could see any significant change as a result of that process?
I really hope so, because, and I've put this in a letter to Andrea Leadsom today as well. So last Monday afternoon, I presented at the panel for DDRB on behalf of England contractors. And this was a great thing because we decided to pivot our approach in terms of the evidence base that we accrued for the Department of Health and NHS England in the contract negotiations. We were able to repurpose it for DDRB because it was economic, it was quantitative, it was evidence-based, it was data-driven. So it was actually really helpful. We called that judgment right. And the evidence that we've been able to put forward has been really compelling and robust. So it's absolutely my anticipation and hope above all that DDRB will take on board what we've said. And again, to them, we've said we think 8.7% for contractors in England would do the needful for the next 12 months. Now, I think the delay in the DDRB reporting, because it always used to be reported in January so that you'd be able to work it all out for April, and it's dragged on into July for years now. And I think that's been frustrating for Andrea Leadsom as well. She said that was a real issue. And she did say to me, to give her credit, that she really wanted to do more, but her hands were tied. That she herself has personal friends who are GPs and she really does get it, but that she wasn't able to go any further, but she fought very hard internally. Now, when she gives us nice assurances about DDRB, I really hope they will come good. My worry is that this will be towards the end of July and that the decision will likely rest with Jeremy Hunt as Chancellor of the Exchequer. And I suppose my fears are that as a Chancellor going into an autumn where he's facing a general election, he might want to prioritise saving 5 pence off a litre of petrol than giving money into the GP contract. And the main concern for me, as I said to Andrea Leadsom and her special advisor and directors of the Department of Health, was that money landing in a practice bank account in November, as it did with last year's award, isn't going to help those practices facing a lack of financial viability now, who are going to have to sustain the next 7 months of the financial year. And spending money in 7 months' time is more expensive than spending money today. Any economist can tell you that. So we urgently need recognition of investment erosion from this April to prevent practice closures across England. We need it now. And I am not going to give up on that. And I am not going to stop banging that drum. And if DDRB come out with really helpful news, and if the government come out with really positive commitments to investing in it, I will be delighted. But what a shame to lose that credit with all these hardworking practices and practice staff and contractors and partners between now and July, and then waiting potentially even more months as we did last year to get the monies landing. What a loss of credit in that account for the one sector of the NHS that is increasing its productivity, that has taken no action, that ends the year in 0% deficit, and that has delivered on all of the government commitments. It's a funny way to treat your best performing sector.
I've heard you talk about that before, and I've actually was talking to another GP who was talking about the fact that, like you said there, general practice is the one bit of the NHS that has a zero deficit. There's nobody has to come and bail them out at the end of the year like you do with hospitals. Are you really concerned that we are going to start to see more and more practice closures if there's nothing changes on the funding this year?
Yeah, I am. I really am. This isn't dramatic hyperbole. This isn't trying to do a sort of political pitch to put pressure onto people. I genuinely am. Viscerally, I feel this. I had medical accountancy companies contacting me through Twitter, through direct messaging, to share their data from their 100, 200, 500 practices, looking at the average incomes across September, October, and thinking, oh my goodness. Because it's one thing if it's one practice. It's quite something else if it's hundreds of practices across every region in England. It's a bit like if you owe the bank £1,000, it's your problem. But if you owe the bank £1 million, it's the bank's problem. This is NHS England's problem. And it's going to cause patient harm. When you decide to hand a contract back, my goodness, you do not make that decision lightly. That is a decision where your head and your heart are in conflict. And I've got a number of friends who are partners who are delivering amazing quality of care in really reputable, well thought of training practices where they are not taking any drawings, and they haven't taken any drawings for many months, so that they can keep on paying their salaried staff. And we have such robust evidence of partners taking reduced drawings. The feedback from our practice finance data that came through between Christmas and New Year, and it shows that people are desperate to share it if they're willing to do all of that between Christmas and New Year. I mean, I felt like such a horrible person messaging them on Boxing Day, but I was so grateful because we got so many coming through. And the average reduction in income for those partners who fulfilled this survey, it's over 10% of practices, was 23.5%. That's almost a quarter, and that's the average. So how many more is being lost in those who are below the 50% average? So this is real. This is happening. And it's happening from every quarter, every region, whether you're rural or urban, whatever your Cahill, the numbers don't stack up because of the impact of inflation. What was worth the pounds in my pocket in 2019 isn't today. There's been over a 20% attrition. And we've got to get wiser as to what this really means and call it out for what it is.
What happens now? I mean, obviously, the referendum launched last week. If GPs reject the deal in the referendum, are we on a path towards industrial action then? Can you just sort of talk through the process that will happen from here on out?
Of course. So the referendum, there's a number of reasons. I really was very keen to get consensus across the profession, because it's very easy when you're sitting in a room of negotiation at the Department of Health or NHS England, and there's four of you, myself, Samira, Julius and David, to be told, oh, that's not what other GPs tell us. Are you representative? Well, actually, we want to make it clear that this isn't just the hunch of four people in a room. This is the groundswell of support from the wider profession. And it's really important to do that. That also helps galvanise, energise, politicise and exercise much greater attention from the profession. And it means that GPs are also given an opportunity to be able to say, no, I'm sorry, this isn't good enough and this is unacceptable. And what's happening to us is unacceptable. We get told, oh, it's fine, because over 99% of practices are signed up to PCNs. They love it. And I'm like, well, when 50% of your income is determined on having been part of it, I wouldn't confuse, you know, sign up for support. It's a Hobson's choice. And yeah, I think you can give plenty of examples where PCNs have done some really cool stuff. And you've got plenty of examples where it's been an awful lot of bureaucracy and heartache and headache for not a lot in return as well. There's the importance of giving GPs an opportunity to exercise their own mandate. That's really important. Secondly, it was a will of the Conference of England LMCs in November. And that is really important as well. Thirdly, it's a very powerful message to government. It's a very powerful message to ministers, because they don't like noise in a general election year. And I want to give them every opportunity to stop this chain of events from happening. It's really important that we are professional and responsible in our actions, because people won't have any truck if we try and go too far too fast. But also for the BMA, the BMA has done an incredible amount of work with consultants, with staff grades and associate specialists, and with junior doctors. We've seen massive membership increases. We're pretty much at 200,000 doctors now in the BMA. But what we haven't had, because there hasn't been that opportunity, is a chance to really focus on the needs of GPs as a branch of practice and the plurality of our membership. So we might be working in a ED setting, delivering general practice, or in an out of hours, or you might have been forced out of the NHS and now working in a multiple number of settings, perhaps even privately, or just doing a bit of locuming in the NHS. And you might want a chance to go, the reason I've left is because of this. It's no good. And I'm not going to come back unless you're going to make it better. As well as all of the partners out there and salaried GPs and locums and GP registrars. And everyone say, well, why is it more than just a contractor? Why is it more than partners? And I'm like, guys, this is a chance for us to show unanimity of approach and a singular mindset. And all GPs will be delivering this contract sat in a practice setting, not just partners. And for a patient out there, they don't care the contractual status of the GP they see. When they lose their GP, or when their GP drops sessions, or when their GP decides to take an early retirement, they're losing their GP. And they don't care whether that's a salaried GP or a partner, it's their GP. So it's important that we as a profession also focus on what's important here. And I think that's to gain a temperature check of the profession that's going to help us inform our next steps.
And it's just BMA members, isn't it? It's all GP BMA members in England that will be able to vote. Is that right?
That's right, Emma. And the reason for that is that if we want the same that's been given to consultants and staff grades and juniors, they've had civica, independent, professional, objective, impartial referenda and ballots done. We need the same. We're not going to do this on a Survey Monkey or the back of a fag packet or a Slido poll. This needs to be done professionally so it can be seen as legitimate in the eyes of our external stakeholders. And so the BMA can only pass on the membership details for those who it holds. And so I'd encourage everyone to join the BMA before the 21st of March to guarantee that you will get a vote in this referendum. And honestly, I need as many to join the BMA as possible, because compared with, as a proportion, compared with, say, juniors or consultants who have, of course, been through recent ballots, we're falling behind in our membership. And I think there's a lot to be said for us all coming together to try and save the profession and raise the temperature as we head into the general election.
If the profession rejects the deal in the referendum, which, let's be honest, seems quite likely, what happens then? Where do we go then? Are we on the way towards industrial action, and how would that work?
Well, as we've talked about already today, we've spoken about DDRB and we've spoken about a general election. So I think it would be naive to suggest that we're not considering industrial action, because at this point we have to. However, it is well within the government's gift to avoid the need for that conversation. This is a political choice that ministers must make, and we need to give them every opportunity to recuse us having to go down that line, because that's a last resort. It's kind of like advocating surgery to a patient. You start with conservative management, then you put in medical management, and as a last resort, you counsel for a surgical approach. And it's exactly the same. We're not at the stage yet where we're talking about what's going to happen and when it's going to happen, because we don't want it to happen. As I've said, it's absolutely within government's gift to avoid the need for any kind of action from GPs. But if we're forced into that line, we will go down that line. And so I think the next step for us is we want to produce guidance on the contract, and we're going to do that next month. GPC England are going to meet on the 28th of March, which is Maundy Thursday, after the referendum. Then we've got the Easter bank holiday weekend. Then the 1st of April, I think we'll see the contract being imposed. We'll come out with guidance that April. In May, we've got UK Conference of LMCs and GPC England meeting again, and we want to produce our manifesto, our vision for general practice at that time. And then we're going to announce dates where we're going to go out and do face-to-face roadshows. And at the moment, the referendum webinars are very much broadcast. But when it comes to those face-to-face roadshows across the region, it's going to be very much us listening. Because I appreciate that I've been thinking through this, as have all my colleagues, a great deal for a long time. But these scenarios and suggestions and plans are new to the GPs out there who'll be undertaking them. And so they will need to work through the conversations in the same way we've worked through the conversations and understand what would work and what probably would not work. And the most important thing is being able to bring everybody with you. That is paramount. So we want to have those face-to-face conversations and roadshows. And then I think you would need to, if you're forced to, and you've got to make allowance on your mind for DDRB here, signalling, you know, when you might need to move to a ballot if no one's listening and no one is offering you any potential alternatives. And then you map that out. And that's what needs to happen. But as I've said, it's within government's gift to completely avoid this conversation. Totally. That is an absolute political choice for ministers to make. And it's really important that we make the case now so that they can see this is the only choice we have. It's like you work through every possible option for management with a condition with your patient.
What types of industrial action do you think we might be looking at? Are you able to talk about that at the minute, or is that something that would come after those roadshows?
That's exactly the discussion to have in the roadshows.
Right.
But I think there's lots of areas of collective action that would work very well in general practice. The key points for me is I don't want patients to be piggy in the middle, because that won't work for patients and it won't work for GPs. We are not like the junior doctors. We are not like the consultants, and we're not like the staff and associate specialists. We're totally different. We are right in there in our communities with our patients. Our front door and our reception staff are in our community. So what we do needs to bring patients with us. And actually, patients aren't to blame. The government's to blame, NHS England's to blame, and the Department of Health is to blame. So I want our action to harm them, not our patients. And it's that framework that we are considering.
One of the things I've heard you talk about a lot as well is the BMA safe working guidance for general practice. I mean, what role do you see that playing for practices in the coming months as they're dealing with, you know, inordinate amounts of pressure and not enough money? How can that help them, and how would you recommend practices use it?
So that's a really good example, and I think it's very important. So let's say you're queuing up in a supermarket and the cashiers are working as fast as they can to process the shopping items. Queues are getting longer and longer and longer, and everyone's getting annoyed in the queues because they can see empty cashiers that aren't full. Are they blaming the cashiers at the tills who are trying to work as hard as they can, or are they blaming the shop for not putting more cashiers to open up more aisles? The same is true for our safe working guidance. We need to see the safe maximum number of patients a day. And it's not the GP's fault if they're being forced to work in an unsafe boiled frogs scenario. It is the NHS's fault for not allowing funding for additional GPs and additional nurses. If you look at the outpatient recovery programme and the elective recovery programme and the almost 8 million patients waiting on hospital lists, no one's blaming the hospitals. They're blaming the NHS, and in some cases, they're blaming GPs. Now, the exponential uptake in the graph of the waiting lists came in not on account of COVID, but it was expedited by trusts moving on to block contracts, the same block contracts that we deliver, the all-you-can-eat buffet contracts rather than an a la carte menu. So trusts very quickly understood they'd only be able to deliver a certain number of colonoscopies, a certain number of flexicystoscopies, a certain number of OGDs, a certain number of MRIs, and they costed it accordingly, and they have continued that activity accordingly. And because their costs were cut and put a ceiling on top, then they are only going as fast around their hamster wheel as they can afford to. And I need GP practices to understand the speed of their own hamster wheels. And if they put in place a safe speed, then they are safely looking after the patients that they see. Their teams feel safer. Their salaried GPs feel safer. Their nursing staff feel safer. I agree, we need to better articulate and describe how potentially to build this in at a practice level to protect our reception, our care navigation staff and our administrative staff so that they don't get the brunt of how patients feel in terms of frustration. We hear it all the time about how there's an access problem. We also know that we see 1 in 2 of the population every month. And when you spell that out, everyone is agog. How can it be an access problem? Unless it's accessing a GP, because we know we've got 2,000 fewer of them, their solution is access. But access to whom? For what? You know, if you're going to have to come and see somebody 5 times to actually end up seeing a GP and getting the diagnosis and your treatment, that's not helping the patient. And it's bringing patients with us. It's helping them understand where the problems are here, that their money, their taxes are not being put to best effect in terms of productivity and getting what they want and what they feel they deserve as patients. If we were to have as many GPs as we had in, say, 2008, and I absolutely personally believe that it's still cheap as chips in terms of the wider budget of the NHS. This is a political choice not to spend that money in general practice compared to trust. It's just eye-watering sums. Then absolutely you'd have sufficient GPs. But at the moment, we've got 6 million more patients registered on patient lists, 2,000 fewer GPs. And if you've got the 1.4 billion being spent on additional roles, that would buy you 14,000 GPs. So there are ways to make the job less toxic. There are ways to embed joy, hope, stability and safety into the GP contract. And to choose not to do so is completely ideological. And I don't believe it's what patients want. And it's definitely not what the profession wants. And if we're seeing nearly 1.4 million patients on average every day, that's almost 1.5 million voters every day. About time we start talking to those voters about what's really going on.
Do you think patients are starting to get the message about the level of underfunding general practice is currently experiencing? And how powerful do you think that message could become if patients and GPs make the case together for more funding?
So I think a really good example from last week is in Northwest London, when patient groups worked with London-wide LMCs to pause the plans to move to same-day urgent access. That's really critical. I think when you've got patients and GPs working together in unanimity, that's immense. As a GP, my goodness, I share patients' frustrations with being able to get through to their surgery, get an appointment with the doctor. It's not right. We want to be able to see our patients just as much as they want to see us. It's why we became GPs in the first place. We weren't trained to put up these barriers. We weren't trained to reject referrals. We weren't trained to undertake ever more hospital-based investigations and try and hold on to that risk. We are expert generalists. We're not trained to deliver secondary care and try and just keep patients in a holding pattern circulating around hospitals. So that's why we became GPs, to help patients, to give high-quality patient-centred care. And we're not being allowed to do that. It's not safe. And it's really important that we're honest with them rather than just colluding in this ideological dismantling of the job we were trained to provide.
It's really interesting, that point, isn't it, about North West London? Because I think like one of the big objections for patients there as well was the way they were proposing staffing those hubs in particular. Like you said earlier, that was one of the real sticking points, I think. One thing I just wanted to ask as well, which hopefully may be a bit more positive, how long do you think it could take to turn all this around? You know, is there a hope that with a change of government after the next general election, the kind of landscape for general practice could improve, do you think?
I think we have to think that, don't we? Because otherwise, what's the point? And I do think that, otherwise I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. What's so important is that it's a possibility that we have a change of government, and with a change of government, we might have a change of mandate. And so it's equally vital that I can meet a new Secretary of State for Health and Social Care and meet them on a level with a big mandate behind me. And if that includes patients, then all the better. But if we're going to keep on going down this route of general practice access and the fuller stock take that NHS England and the Department of Health are so wedded to, the only horse in the game, then I think we're going to have some difficulties, because we're just going to see a continuation of the road we're on now, which is not working for patient outcomes in terms of the research that's coming forth, and it's not working for the retention and the recruitment across the profession. So we can think differently. We are the government's plan A, and I think perhaps the biggest shock that will happen to any government that comes in is understanding the finances, because we're not in a great place. This is not 1997. This is very, very different. And so if you've got much less financial resource than you perhaps appreciated you might have, you're going to look to see what offers greatest bang for your buck. And time again, that's the partnership model. If it's allowed to flourish, it offers immense value, and it manages as good as any to square that circle of quick, cheap and safe. You can choose two out of the three, but with partnership, we're trying to do all three. But safe is at risk, because we're being asked to be too quick, seeing too many and too cheap, and we can't do it. So the numbers don't add up.
Have you met Wes Streeting and Labour? Because obviously Wes Streeting and Sir Keir Starmer have both in the past been quite critical of the partnership model. I mean, there's been a sign that they're kind of coming round to it. That's going to be really important, making that case to them. I mean, obviously making massive assumptions that they are the next government, but according to all the polls, it's looking quite likely at the minute. Have you spoken to them about that, or to Wes Streeting in particular about that at all?
Oh, I think it's immensely important. And I think we can also note that Wes Streeting and Keir Starmer have changed what they're saying about general practice in recent months. And absolutely, I'm talking to them and their teams, and to other shadow ministers and their teams, and other political parties and their teams, the Lib Dems in particular, Daisy Cooper, their health spokesperson. You know, they're very much focusing on GPs. So I'd encourage all practices to work with prospective parliamentary candidates of any party. Anybody who's up for election suddenly is much better at using their listening ears. And using your patient participation groups is really key. And that's why we want to produce tools for PPGs and for waiting rooms and infographics that make this case, because it's a really compelling case. And I genuinely believe that what the profession needs and what patients want are the same thing.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, Katie. Thank you for your time.
It's an absolute pleasure. Really grateful for having me, Emma. So thank you ever so much.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and thank you so much to Katie for finding the time to talk with me today. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do think about giving us a rating or a review. It really does help us out. I'll be back next week with our regular news review, so please do join me then. In the meantime, don't forget you can keep up to date with all the latest news affecting primary care and access a host of other resources on our website at gponline.com.